When I first came to Christ, I was about to turn 17. And it became one of the most tumultuous times of my life because I came from a background where I knew virtually nothing about God, and I'd lived my life knowing virtually nothing about God, lived a life that looked like I knew nothing about God. And suddenly I had my eyes opened to the life of following Jesus Christ. And so a war raged within me. God was calling me to follow Jesus. And so there were certain things about my past life that I knew I had to leave behind, things that I had to turn away from, and things that I had to embrace in a life of following Jesus. And yet there was my old life always calling me back, always tempting me. These two things were at war within me. I think this is true for many who seek to follow Jesus. I know I made many mistakes in that time. Probably my biggest mistake was a pendulum swing attitude. Sometimes I'd embrace a kind of legalism where I'd be like, no, I can't. And I'd beat myself up every time I got it wrong. And I'd strive and make laws to try and protect myself. And then I'd swing the other way to saying, oh, it's all just too hard. I may as well just go back and embrace what's there. Jesus will forgive me anyway. In hindsight, I reckon the biggest reason I struggled so much was because my focus was more on what other people thought of me than actually pursuing Christ. When I was in church world, I was focused on what people in church world thought of me, and there was a way I thought they wanted me to live. And when I was hanging out with my old friends, I was fearful of what they would think of me if they found out about my faith or if they found out what that faith meant for my life. And so I kind of just melted back in to that old life. I shared this with a good pastor mentor at the time, and he said to me, Christians are supposed to be weird. And it stuck with me ever since. Weirdest bit of advice, but it's rung true. Christians are supposed to be weird. We're supposed to look different from the world around us. We're supposed to be a little bit weird. When we consider the churches of Asia that Jesus is passionately writing to in the power of the Holy Spirit, we have to understand that they would have felt this difference, this weirdness of coming to Christ acutely. Think of the three cities that we're looking at today. Ephesus was a city steeped in traditional pagan worship. There was a temple in Ephesus to the goddess Artemis, a goddess of fertility. Worship of Artemis was costly. You had to give money to the temple. It was extravagant and it was erotic, with worshippers engaging in sexual practices with temple prostitutes to ensure her favor. Pergamum was a beautiful city filled with art and culture. It was a center of the arts in Asia Minor. It had a 10,000-seat theater, which apparently, if you stood on the stage and whispered, you could be heard in the nosebleed section. Such were the acoustics. It had an ancient library that was rivaled around the Roman Empire. It was an amazing place full of beauty and architecture and culture. But it was also a city steeped in dark, religious and superstitious bondage. Temples to the Emperor Domitian, temples to Zeus, temples to Athena dominated the city. And there was even a center of healing dedicated to Asclepius, the Greek serpent god, where sick people would go, be put into a drug-induced trance and lain on the ground and have non-venomous snakes crawl all over them. And if the snakes crawled all over them, it was the healing power of this god being transmitted to them. Thyatira was the smallest of the cities that Jesus wrote to here in Revelation, but it was a military town, a center for many trade guilds as well. And since fueling the idol worship by making icons and images was the bread and butter for these trade guilds, the protection of the idol worship was huge in that city. And because trades and military are full of young single men, revelry and licentiousness dominated the culture. In their own ways, each of these cities embodied the kind of culture and life that would have made the Church of Jesus Christ seem incredibly weird. To step out of that life and into a life of following Jesus would have made you seem very weird. So this means that the Christians and the churches in these cities would have experienced that same wrestle that I did. The wrestle between the new life Christ was calling them to and the prevailing culture of their city. In fact, their wrestle would have even been more intense because there was more than just social isolation on the line for them. At times, each of these cities experienced the kind of persecution we heard about last week. To stand out from the crowd in these cities was putting a target on your head for financial hardship, imprisonment, violence, and death. But where Jesus' words to the persecuted churches of Smyrna and Philadelphia that we heard last week were all gentle and uplifting and full of commendation, to the churches in the cities of Ephesus, Pergamum, and Thyatira, they get somewhat of a mixed review. In each church, in each city, there was something that Jesus was concerned about. And as we look at these concerning trends this morning, I believe we are going to be challenged with the troubling truth that the church hasn't really ever escaped this danger. This morning, we are going to be confronted with the fact that we are always on the brink of embracing what Jesus is concerned about in his church. Last week, we saw that the church that Jesus commends is the church that clings to him. It was pure and it was simple. Jesus commends churches that just cling to him. And if we look at each of these churches, it seems as though they are in this camp. They are clinging to Jesus. Ephesus in verse 2, I know your works, your toil and your patient endurance and how you cannot bear with those who are evil, but have tested those who call themselves apostles and are not and have found them to be false. I know you're enduring patiently and bearing up for my name's sake and you have not grown weary. Pergamum in verse 13, I know where you dwell, where Satan has his throne. And yet you hold fast to my name and you did not deny my faith, even in the days of Antipas, my faithful witness, who was killed among you where Satan dwells. And Thyatira, verse 19, I know your works, your love and faith and service and patient endurance, and that your latter works exceeded the first. These churches are patiently enduring in faith. Their works match their faith. They strive for the truth of Christ, and they've even held fast to him in the face of great persecution and even martyrdom. It seems to be a picture of churches that are clinging to Jesus Christ. Our Mim loves Ninja Warrior. It was quite bizarre, but from the moment she saw the first ad on TV last year for the Australian series, she just looked at me and gasped and said, oh, we so have to watch that. I was like, okay, we have to watch Ninja Warrior. And so every afternoon, the girls would come home from school, we'd boot up the rehash of last night through the online catch-up, and Mim would ride every bump with the competitors as they made their way through the obstacle courses. Even just yesterday, Mim and her friends were at Bounce, and when we got there, the staff member said, hey, did you girls know that we have a new Ninja Warrior course? And Mim looked at me with eyes that said, this is going to be the best thing ever. She loves it. The thing you realize when you're watching a show like Ninja Warrior is that to be successful, it's not just about being physically strong and fast, powerful and flexible. It's just as much about the planning, the strategy, and the spontaneous decision making you make second by second. Because you can be strong enough to get through the course, but there's plenty of times where it's about your strategy and your decision making and what you do in any given moment. And normally the battle comes because we are two-sided beings. We have a left hand and a right hand, and they are on opposite sides of our bodies. The things that we use to cling on to things are on opposite sides of our body. And so if you can only cling on to something with one hand, you're always fighting a losing battle. Your center of gravity is always against you, and you will always be looking with the other hand for something else to cling on to. And did you know it's possible to cling to Christ, but to only cling to him with one hand? This is exactly what these three churches in question today were doing. Yes, they were clinging to Jesus. Yes, they were enduring in their faith in him and striving for his truth. But they were only clinging with one hand, with one side of the body. And this meant that they were always looking for something else to cling onto with the other hand. And it is in Jesus' words, specifically to the churches of Pergamum and Thyatira, that we see what it was these churches were clinging to with that other hand. Verse 14, "But I have a few things against you. You have some there who hold to the teaching of Balaam, who taught Balak to put a stumbling block before the sons of Israel so they might eat food sacrificed to idols and practice sexual immorality. So also you have some who hold to the teaching of the Nicolaitans." Verse 20, "But I have this against you, that you tolerate that woman Jezebel, who calls herself a prophetess and is teaching and seducing my servants to practice sexual immorality and to eat food sacrificed to idols." It seems that both of these churches, that there were significant portions of the congregation who were clinging to Jesus with one hand, and with the other hand they were reaching out to a Balaam or to a Jezebel. Jesus uses these Old Testament characters, these two stories, to highlight what it is they're doing and the severity of what they're doing. In Pergamum, Jesus says they've embraced the teaching of Balaam, who taught Balak. The reference here is to a story from Numbers 22. Basically, Balak is the king of Moab. He's seen the Israelites advancing. They've wiped out some other armies. He's fearful they're going to do the same to him. So he needs some help. So he summons Balaam, a pagan prophet, to come and give him some advice. And the advice that Balaam gives Balak is to say, "Tempt the sons of Israel with food sacrificed to idols and with sexual immorality, and it will weaken them and put them out of favor with their God, and you will have the victory." So he throws the children of Israel under the bus by giving away a weak point for them. Basically, Jesus is saying here that there are people in Pergamum who are listening to pagan prophets, listening to the voice of their city, the voice of their culture, and being tempted by the trappings of their culture. It's like they're clinging to Jesus, but they're swinging over towards the prevailing culture to listen to what they have to say as well. And some are reaching out to grab onto whatever this culture is offering, and their grip on Jesus is becoming weak. In Thyatira, Jesus says there is a woman called Jezebel who calls herself a prophetess and has seduced the people of the church. The story of Jezebel comes from 1 and 2 Kings, and she is a famed lady of the Old Testament. She is married to King Ahab, who she then seduces. into worshipping her gods, worshipping the gods of her family. She's a foreign lady. And so she leads both Ahab the king and the whole nation astray, worshipping the other gods. She raises armies of pagan prophets, and she hunts down all the prophets of Yahweh and persecutes them and kills them. Jesus is saying that there are some within the church who have become like foolish King Ahab. They've been enticed into allowing a woman with worldly desires to exercise authority over them and teach them to follow her ways. It's like they're clinging to Jesus with one hand, but reaching out to grab onto what Jezebel has to offer with the other. And their grip on Jesus is becoming weak. And this is what is concerning Jesus about the churches in question today. They have allowed the prevailing culture of their cities to take hold in their churches. They've tried to blend faith in Jesus with the lifestyle and ideology of their city. The cult of the Nicolaitans mentioned in both Ephesus and Thyatira is most likely believed that they had this vision of grace and forgiveness of Jesus that freed them from any moral obligations. Because Jesus has saved me, because he has forgiven me, because my soul has been elevated to heavenly status, I can do whatever I want in the body and I would be still able to claim my salvation from Jesus. This is the kind of teaching that was permeating these churches through the Jezebels and the Balaams that they were reaching out to cling on to. You can do whatever you want and you can still claim your salvation in Jesus. It doesn't take much for us to recognize the same danger in the church today. When we look out at the broader evangelical church, I think we have to admit that far too often we seem just like the hapless ninja warrior, clinging to Jesus with one hand, but desperately looking around for other things to cling on to as well. And generally what we reach for, what we find attractive, are the things that our prevailing culture is selling to us. The go-to places for the churches of Asia, as Jesus outlines them here, seem to be repeated over and over again. Idolatry and sexual immorality. Food sacrificed to idols and sexual immorality. And you know it isn't that different for us today either. If there's anything that our generation of Christianity struggles with, it's the hypersexualized world in which we live and its idols of riches, popularity, and power. All too easy, we try and hang on to Jesus and reach out to sexual gratification through porn or Tinder or pushing the boundaries in our relationships. Embracing the corporate climb with the same power-hungry attitude as everyone else around us. Self-absorbed spending while only giving lip service to the needs of others. And probably more than anything else, the quest to be liked, to be followed, to be respected, for people to think that we're worth looking at, listening to, engaging with, that we be the kind of person that other people want to be around. This is what our culture is known for. And in far too many cases, it marks the lives of believers as well. But just like my pastor mentor said to me, Jesus doesn't save us so that we would look like the world around us. He saved us so that we might be a little bit weird, that we might be a little bit different, that we might be like him. And he always stands different from the prevailing culture of the world. The thing that concerns Jesus in his church is his people reaching out to find hope from the prevailing culture around them instead of just clinging to him. Jesus is deeply concerned when we think we have a spare hand free to go reaching for something other than him. If the churches in Pergamum and Thyatira tell us what it is that concerns Jesus in his church, the church in Ephesus tells us why we end up in that position, why we end up letting go with one of our hands and reaching out to find satisfaction and hope in other places. See, when we look at it in such plain and simple terms, like only clinging to Jesus with one hand and reaching out to the world with the other hand, we can't imagine that we would ever do it. Logically, why would we do that? Well, did you know that logically, most of the population knows they will never, ever win Gold Lotto? Never, ever will ever win it. They know that the chances of picking the right numbers are astronomical. And yet, a significant portion of our population goes out week by week, even several times a week, and enters Gold Lotto, knowing that they probably don't have a chance of winning, knowing that the money could be easily better spent on other things, and yet week by week they go out and they enter. Why? Not because we think we can win, because we desperately want to win. It is the desire of our heart to win. Our heart sees that ad on TV where the parents pay off the child's house, and there's all warm and happy feels and cuddles. Or the couple get to go on the trip of a lifetime that they've always longed to go on. And our heart sees these things and it yearns to win Gold Lotto. Our head is saying, don't be an idiot. It's 1 in 75 billion chance of picking the right numbers. It's a waste of money. But our heart says, got to be in it to win it. Got to be in it to win it. We long to win. In the same way, logically, those of us who follow Jesus know that he is more than enough for us. We know that he is far more satisfying than anything the world can offer. We know that he is the only place we should be looking to for hope. We know we should be clinging to him with both of our hands. But letting go with one of those hands rarely has anything to do with what we might or might not know. It has much more to do with how we feel. Listen to Jesus' words to the church in Ephesus in verse 4. But this I have against you. You have abandoned the love you had at first. As maybe more famous translation, you have forsaken your first love. Like the hopeful lotto entrant, our hearts take charge of our heads. And we reach out to the world, not because we think we can find satisfaction there, but because we desperately want to find satisfaction there. Jesus diagnoses this problem astutely by calling the Ephesian heart to attention. They had abandoned their first love. They have somehow forgotten the way in which Jesus captivated their hearts when they first came to Christ. Listen to some of the Apostle Paul's language when he wrote to the Ephesian church in their early days. In chapter 1, he says, "In love, God predestined us for adoption to him as sons through Jesus Christ, according to the purpose of his will, to the praise of his glorious grace with which he has blessed us in the beloved." Chapter 2, "But God, being rich in mercy because of the great love with which he loved us, even when we were dead in our trespasses, made us alive together with Christ." And from verse 3, "That you, being rooted and grounded in love, may have strength to comprehend with all the saints what is the breadth and length and height and depth, and to know the love of Christ that surpasses all knowledge." When Jesus says to them in verse 5, "Remember from where you have fallen," this is what he means. There was a time when the affection of the Ephesian heart was captivated by Jesus Christ, was in love with Jesus Christ. But now Jesus knows that this affection is wavering. It's most likely that competing loves had crept into the path of their hearts and affection and had overridden their logic. They knew Jesus was trustworthy. They knew he was satisfying, that he was working for their good. They just didn't feel it in their hearts. And herein lies our greatest struggle, the struggle with our affections. Logically, we know the idols of the world are futile. We know they won't last, that they won't deliver, that they won't satisfy us. Logically, we know that embracing sexual immorality is a fallacy, that porn is fake, that Tinder is momentary, that pushing sexual boundaries is destined for disaster. We know idols will let us down. We know sexual immorality is a fallacy, but our hearts desperately hope they won't be. Our hearts desperately say, you've got to be in it to win it. And this is why everything goes wrong. Because we trusted in some relationship, some possession, some quest for power or popularity. When everything goes wrong, what do we say to ourselves? How could I have been so stupid? That was a dumb decision. We know it was a dumb decision because we followed our heart. We followed our heart. Our heart trumped our head. But this diagnosis by Jesus helps us to understand what he calls these churches to do in response to his uncovering of their heart issues. Because Jesus doesn't say, know more about me. Study harder, try harder, work harder, think better. He doesn't appeal to their minds. He appeals to their hearts. And he does it in two ways. In many ways, apocalyptic literature with its imagery and its visionary and its multi-sensory illustrations is designed to captivate the heart before it captivates our mind. It's designed to do something, to stir something up within us. So listen to the way that Jesus introduces himself to each church. Verse 1 to Ephesus, the words of him who holds the seven stars in his right hand and who walks among the seven golden lampstands. To Pergamum in verse 12, the words of him who has the sharp two-edged sword. And to Thyatira in verse 18, the words of the Son of God who has eyes like a flame of fire and whose feet are like burnished bronze. Remember last week, he introduces himself to the persecuted church, struggling church, with images of his power over the rest of the world to encourage them. Well, here he uses images that describe his authority over the church, his right to judge the church. He holds the seven stars, which are the seven angels of the seven churches. He walks among the seven lampstands, which are the seven churches. He has a two-edged sword, which we know to be his word that he speaks to his church coming out of his mouth. He has eyes of truth that flame with fire and feet of burnished bronze. These are images and that are designed to defibrillate the hearts of the people and snap them back to reality. I am Jesus of the church. I am Jesus who has authority over the church. And there's no point looking out there with that hand and thinking you can only hold on to me with one. I am Jesus of the church. I demand both of your hands. It is supposed to snap the church back to the reality of his authority over them. And secondly, as he closes out each letter, he gives them a taste of what awaits those who cling to him. In Ephesus, verse 7, "To the one who conquers, I will grant to eat from the tree of life, which is in the paradise of God." Verse 17, "To the one who conquers, I will give some of the hidden manna, and I will give him a white stone with a new name written on it that no one knows except the one who receives it." And to Thyatira in verse 26, "The one who conquers and keeps my works until the end, to him I will give authority over the nations, and he will rule them with a rod of iron, as when earthen pots are broken to pieces. Even as I myself have received authority from my Father, and I will give him the morning star." These images are designed to redirect the focus of our hearts away from what the world has to offer in the momentary and towards what Jesus has to offer for all of eternity. We are supposed to see chalk and cheese. We're supposed to see the stark difference between the sexual immorality and the food sacrificed to idols, things that are over in a moment and leave us broken, to the things of eternity, the things of the new heavens and the new earth, which satisfy us forever, and they satisfy us to the max. So here's the deal. More than anything, if we are going to cling to Jesus with both hands and not let one of those hands slip off and reach out to try and find some hope or satisfaction in the world, we need to have our hearts captivated by the one who is holding on to us. He is the authority of the church. He is our first audience and our final judge. He is holding on to you. So often we think of our relationship with Jesus about how tightly am I holding him. He is the one holding you. And his grip on you demands both of your hands to cling to him. And we need to have our hearts captivated by where he is taking us with that grip that he holds us with. He is taking us to an eternally satisfying destination where all the riches, the popularity, and the power, and the sexual gratification, and the idol worship of this world can't compare with the gifts that he has stored up for us. So let's make this practical. Tomorrow, when you go to work, and that opportunity to strive for that promotion, to walk all over your co-workers to get it, to do everything possible to grab on to that extra money, that extra status, that extra respect comes up, you need to look to Jesus, who is the authority in your life, who has a hold on you, and who has something, a promotion that we can't even manage to grapple within our brains, waiting for you, a promotion to the new heavens and the new earth. When you are tempted searching online, when you are tempted walking down the street, when you are tempted in relationship to embrace some momentary sexual pleasure, you need to look to Christ, the one who has authority, who holds onto you with a tender but unbreakable grip. You need to look to the one who has eternal satisfaction stored up for you in the new heavens and the new earth. And you need to let your heart be captivated by him. You know it already, don't you? You know that he is so much better than a promotion, that he is so much better than sexual gratification. But we need to have our hearts convinced of that, to be reminded of the love with which he loved us, so that we will never let go of our first love. That is what Jesus is concerned about in his church, that our hearts might waver in our affections for him, and it would cause us to let go with one hand and maybe try and bring some of the world into our relationship with Jesus, to try and somehow merge the two. That is what Jesus is deeply concerned with in his church. And Rosalie Church, I pray that we would have hearts captivated by the love of Christ, and that our first love would never waver.